Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special Empire podcast with the great George A. Romero, the man who is, in many ways, the father of modern horror. Known mostly, of course, for his amazing zombie films, his early trilogy, especially of Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead, showed that horror films could be used as Trojan horses to hide social commentary in amongst the scares. But he's not just about zombies, as anyone who's seen Martin, Creepshow, The Crazies, or even his non-horror films, including the brilliant and mad Knight Riders, will know. George was in London recently to appear at the BFI's Gothic season, and he came in to talk to me and Phil Dissemblian about his glittering career, including opportunities missed. Thanks so much, by the way, to the BFI for making this happen. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the legend that is George A. Romero. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Welcome to London. How are you?
Oh, good. A bit, sort of recovering a little bit from a flight yesterday, but doing fine.
Okay. Do you have any tips that you've accrued over the years for how to handle jet lag? And
no, I don't. Unfortunately, I don't.
Does it just get worse? It's getting worse for me as I get older. Is it getting worse for you?
Well, everything is getting worse for me as I get older. So.
But you're in London for the BFI Gothic
yes.
season.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic, I think, because such a venerable institution honouring horror films. That's great, isn't it? That's a bit of a breakthrough in a way.
It's terrific, yeah. No, listen, anytime, you know, we get a, like, the community of fantasy filmmakers, you know, whenever we take a little, take credit wherever we can get it. So, it's really terrific. And, of course, it's Alan Jones is there.
Yeah.
Helping out.
And, yeah.
He's been a real champion of the genre for years.
A long time,
yeah,
absolutely. And you're doing a talk. This will play after the talk is over, but you're doing a talk tomorrow night at the BFI on Friday night. And Dario Argento's in town as well. So
yes,
I presume you're hanging out with Dario, or
not
are
yet?
You ships tonight.
I'm sure hoping to. Yeah, we're having dinner tonight, I believe.
Okay.
With Dario.
Okay.
Yeah,
but, and
you know, we try to see each other whenever we're in the same city. We've worked together actually a couple of times.
Yeah.
And we made up two halves of a film together called Two Evil Eyes.
That's right, yeah.
And he shot one of the episodes and I shot the other. And then, of course, he produced Dawn of the Dead, Zombie. In Italy, it was called Zombie. In the U.S., it was called Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah. I was just listening, actually, as a warm-up for this interview, because we were very excited about you coming in today. And I was listening to the Goblin soundtrack for Dawn of the Dead. And it's amazing when you listen to that soundtrack on its own, and people come in and go, oh, this is great, this is quite funky, it's quite jazzy, what is it? And you go, it's a soundtrack to Dawn of the Dead, one of the greatest horror movies of all time. It's so atypical. It's completely not what you would expect.
No, it is, I know. And well, and we sort of made a deal. I mean, they had done a couple of things with Dario prior to Dawn. And then the deal that we made with Dario was that right from the beginning, he said that he would like to have more control. He would let me make the film U.S. English language any way that I wanted, and gave me all the creative controls.
Yeah.
But he wanted to control the non-English language territories because he thought they would want less humor, and they would want a different kind of music, which was Goblin's music.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I was able to, for the English language version, use as much or as little of the Goblin as I wanted, and I actually did use a whole eclectic collection of library tracks. To augment, and some of them were much more traditional horror sounding tracks. But then I couldn't resist the, you know, those big, ballsy goblin moments. You know,
it's interesting. I was chatting to one of our team about this, and he was saying that you obviously use less goblin on your version than Dario did on his.
Yeah.
And was that a reflection of the fact that you perhaps weren't as big a fan of their sound? But it sounds like you just were a bigger fan of other sounds as well.
Yes, exactly. That's really it. I love the sound, but I didn't think that it was appropriate, just as you were saying. You know, you listen to that track and it doesn't sound like, I don't think I could have scored the whole film with that kind of music, you know.
There are a lot of fiddles on the there's a lot more violin than you might expect, and not in a traditional Hitchcock shrieking violin kind of way. Very much, you know, hoedown kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We're going to intersplice this chat with some questions from our readers via Twitter. And just whilst we're on the subject, it seemed to make sense to bring up one from @moosedog23, who wondered if you fell out with Dario Argento after seeing his edit of Dawn of the Dead.
Not at all. No. Yeah, you know, we had the deal right from the beginning, and we didn't fall out at all. There was a little bit of tension, not between us, but between the distributors on the U.S. side and the non-English language side, because his version was being censored more.
Yeah.
I think even here in the U.K., they wanted to cut two and a half minutes out of his version. And when we showed them the version with the jokes in it, with the humor, which basically one of the big things that Dario thought no one would get, but they came back with only 30 seconds of cuts.
Oh, really? Okay.
So they felt that the humor, softened the blow, I guess.
It's so strange looking back at any furore that Dawn of the Dead caused. Because it's so clearly cartoonish. The blood is bright red.
Yeah.
Unlike Day of the Dead, which is very gory and very realistic.
Yeah.
Were you surprised at the time by the fact that Dawn caused such a fuss with censors? And
not really, because the Night of the Living Dead had been slaughtered, you know, by Ebert and a bunch of people who said, look how far filmmakers will go if we give them enough lead. It was one of the films that was used really by people who were campaigning for some sort of MPAA control or some sort of, you know, in-house industry control over... never calling it censorship. So no, I wasn't surprised about it. In fact, I sort of expected it, because in my mind, even though it was comic booky, you know, it was comic booky in the old EC comic book sense, you know, Tales from the Crypt and all that, which they were brutal. They were really gory in those days, you know. People tearing up, you know, a baseball player's heart out and using it for first base. it's the kind of stuff that I grew up
on. We laugh now, but...
Yeah, we laugh. But see, some of us can laugh at that. I laugh at that kind of stuff. I know that's... a lot of people, you know, have to hide their eyes and run from the room.
You mentioned Roger Ebert wrote a very, it was a damning piece, but not specifically about the film, which he subsequently reviewed and said that he really very much liked,
right,
Night of the Living Dead. And I wondered if he'd seen it in a screening in Chicago with a lot of young children, because the censorship didn't exist and you could get in at any age to see it, and they were traumatized by it. Have you encountered anyone that saw it at an inappropriate early age since then who's come up and had a chat with you?
No. I personally haven't. Anyone who's seen it and is still angry, I don't know. No, I don't. I haven't. I didn't know. But I know that was the thesis of Rogers, the piece that he wrote, was that this shouldn't be allowed to show this to young children. You know, along with, I forget what the double bill was, but I know for a while it went around with Doctor Who.
Really?
But, I don't think that's what he was talking about. And, you know, it would go around with Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and all these sort of benign horror films, you know, of that era.
And you had no control over any of this, famously, because Night was, I guess, a thorny issue for you in terms of the rights. You lost
control
very
quickly. That happened later.
Okay.
No one realized that we didn't have a copyright on the film. Because our initial title, when we got distribution, our initial title was Night of the Flesh Eaters. And Walter Reed, the eventual distributor, when there was a film currently or a couple of years earlier called The Flesh Eaters. And so they figured we needed to change the title to avoid confusion with that. And so their title was Night of the Living Dead. we, as you know, aspiring filmmakers who didn't really know what to do, had put the copyright bug on the title. So when they changed the title, bug came off.
Yeah.
And nobody noticed. We didn't notice. They didn't notice. And, you know, it went out and it played for the first couple of years and actually returned money. Very unusual turn of events. I mean, we haven't gotten money back on any other film since. and it, you know, it returned approximately four times its budget.
Well, it's interesting because you know, since then Knight has gone through this interesting journey, I guess. There have been different versions of it. And one of our Twitter followers has asked, Bertie D asks, what do you think of the unauthorized version with the new score and new scenes? I imagine, have you seen it? Is that something that you...
I haven't seen it. I know John Russo did a version, I think 30th anniversary or something, mm-hmm. with new music.
Yeah.
And with some additional sequences, which I didn't like at all. And we've since talked about it. Yeah, I really didn't think it was necessary at all. And he wasn't doing that to try to establish a copyright. We did a remake that Tom Savini directed. That was an attempt to establish a copyright. Mm-hmm. But of course, all we did was establish the copyright on the remake. And we also did a colorized version, again, an attempt to... I mean, we authorized a colorized version.
Yeah.
Which, again, I thought it was ridiculous. But, you know, the company is still owned by a group of the initial investors. And so it's sort of, you know, the majority rules when it comes to decisions like that.
But the film is screening at the BFI as part of, I think, after your talk tomorrow night.
Yeah, I hope it's the original film.
it's going to be interesting, isn't it? When was the last time you saw it? I mean, do you revisit it very often? Or?
No, as infrequently as possible. I mean, I often have to see it.
Yeah.
Thankfully, this time I'm not going to be forced to sit in the theater. So
lock the exits and make sure you can't get out.
No. So, I don't, you know, all I see are the mistakes in it, the basic little filmmaking 101 errors, mm-hmm. eye lines and screen directions and all that stuff that I wasn't quite secure with when I made that film.
So you can't necessarily see what other people see in it over the years? And
I've never sort of been able to see all of everything that people see in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, the big premise is that it was meant by us, the filmmakers, to be a racial film, a racial statement, which of course it wasn't. When we wrote the script, John and I wrote the script, John Russo, the character of Ben was a white guy. He mm-hmm. was Caucasian, and the same things happened to him. We didn't change the script, so he still got shot by the posse. Mistaking him for a zombie. They didn't shoot him because he was black. They shot him because they thought he was a zombie. But obviously it became, a sort of a landmark racial statement film. And, you know, it was partly the times when it was released. I mean, Russ Streiner, the producer and old friend of mine, we were driving the very first print, still called Night of the Flesh Eaters, in the trunk of the car to New York. And on the night when we were driving it to New York, that was the night that we heard on the radio Martin Luther King had been assassinated.
Wow.
And so that was the time, you know.
Yeah.
And there was rioting again, which hadn't been happening for a while. And so, you know, it was, I guess, should have expected that it was going to be treated because of Dwayne being black.
What was the reaction like at the time? Because it's hard to imagine now that people might, if that film were released in today's society, people wouldn't necessarily react strongly to that film. But at the time, what was the reaction like?
Well, of course, it sparked a great deal of anger.
Yeah.
I don't think that, you know, all the things that the people that were writing all of this about the film and how important it was for different reasons, were writing it 3 years after the fact, I think, or 2 or 3 years after the fact. People were discovering it and finding things in it that we didn't know were in it. So initially when it went out, it was just this horror film. And I think it did, you know, it did what we wanted it to do, which was push the envelope a little bit on the splatter and on the themes, you know, the disintegration of family. And, you know, it's a dark, film. Mm. And so I think that people who were outraged by it were outraged by it either, as Roger Ebert was, because it was being shown to kids. There were no restrictions then. Or people were just enjoying it. I mean, it made money. It made quite a lot of money in neighborhood theaters and drive-ins and like that, with a limited number of prints.
It seemed like a lot of what Ebert was saying in that particular review was that there's no catharsis at the end of the film. That was that kind of upped the ante for everyone that was watching it. That it made it harder to digest the horror that came before, because there's no moment where everything works out okay. But that must have tied into how people in America were feeling at that time, with the Detroit riots and Vietnam, etc., happening around.
Yeah, I guess so. But of course, one of the things that I really wanted to do, I mean, you make a horror film to upset the apple cart, right? And most films were setting the apple cart up again at the end, setting it upright. And we just didn't want to do that. You know, we just said, wow, man, I mean, what would happen in this situation? Mm. They would shoot the guy.
Yeah.
Even though he's a hero, you know. And that was it. So we were conscious of that. I mean, that was a conscious decision. Mm. And it's funny, because then when I wound up finally doing Dawn of the Dead, mm. which was 10 years later, I called them zombies, first of all. I didn't call them zombies ever in Night of the Living Dead. I didn't think they were zombies. Zombies aren't dead. And I thought I was doing a new thing, you know, bringing the dead back to life and making a new monster. But it turns out all I did was, you know, turn the zombies into neighbors instead of...
But with Dawn, you were talking about 10 years later. And yeah. that's got a much more... Interesting. It's not quite optimistic, because at the end, when Pete and Fran get away, they're still very much in a world filled with zombies, and their life expectancy might not be great, but you keep them alive at the end of the movie.
I did, and it was a dish we actually shot thinking of it as a sequel. Mm. I mistakenly said, well, they all have to die, because it's a sequel to Night of the Living Dead. And during the making of the film, I fell in love with these couple of characters, and I reasoned exactly that. Well, I could leave the world in chaos, and they can get away, at least for a moment.
Yeah.
You know, his last line, Peter's last line is, how much gas do we have? And she says, not much. Yeah. And he just says, okay, let's see what happens.
So perhaps they just go out of shot and then crash.
Yeah.
the true ending of Dawn of the Dead revealed at long last.
But we actually wrote an ending where they died. He shoots himself, which he almost does, mm-hmm. But thinks better of it in the release version of the film. Mm-hmm. And she commits suicide in the helicopter blades.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
And then, but if you had gone down that route, we've been robbed of that wonderful. I think it's a bit of library music, isn't it? When Peter decides to suddenly fight back and escape.
Yeah.
I love that track. It's an amazing track. But it's interesting you're talking about characters, because we recently did a thing on the website, George, called the 666 Greatest Horror Movie Characters of All Time,
right.
And about 20 or 30 came from your movies.
Oh,
and so Peter was number 4. Bub from Day of the Dead was number 17, something like that. And a lot of your great iconic characters are in there. So which is your favorite? You know, looking back on all these characters you've created over the years, do you have one that stands out?
Well, I think Bub is my favorite of all of the ones that I've done. Mm-hmm. He's got to be. I thought Howard's performance was really Karloff-worthy. And I just thought he was terrific. And I like what he stands for. And that's my favorite of my zombie films, Day of the Dead, actually.
Yeah.
So that's easy for me to find a soft spot in my heart for Bub. I don't know who else. I mean, maybe some of the lesser characters. I can't imagine any of my human characters being...
Oh, they made it. They made it. Rhodes was on the list.
Oh, well, Rhodes, you see. Yeah. The villains, of course.
Yeah. Rhodes is on the list. Ben was on the list. Martin was on the list. Your cameo for Martin didn't make it, sadly. But he would be 667 on the list.
I could see Martin too, but see, that's what I'm saying. Well, I guess he is in the end a human character.
Yeah, precisely.
George, we have a question from at Mainstream Matt, who wonders when the last time you were scared in a movie was.
In a movie, you know, I have to go all the way back to The Thing from Another World. You know, I guess I was about 12 or 14. That scared the pants off me. But ever since then, I guess I've just always sort of been aware of that it's only a movie. Right around that same time, I went to see an aunt and uncle of mine took me to see The Tales of Hoffman, Michael Powell's Tales of Hoffman. And I was so enamored of it. It's partly a fantasy film. If the audience doesn't know it, it's opera. It's an opera based on an Offenbach opera.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's I think, the first music video. all sung, and it's all opera and ballet with a couple of ballet sequences added from, I think, Boutique Fantasque. And, you know, I should have been bored to tears by this, but it was a fantasy first. It was a fantasy. The stories are fantastic tales of unrequited love. He falls in love with a vampire and with a robot, and the way I saw it as a kid. And so I was fascinated by it. I could also see what he was doing. I could see the techniques that he was using, printing film in reverse, using double exposures, obvious things that made me realize that and made me believe that I could maybe do this someday. And it's really what started me thinking that I never thought that I would ever have a career, because I thought you had to be born royalty. But I started thinking that I could possibly do it or try to do it. And I started to try to do it with my the same uncle, his little 8 millimeter camera.
Wow.
So I was very aware of technique, and I think that really made me immune to horror, scares.
Yeah.
Did you meet Michael Powell?
Once, yes. I finally got to meet him. We had dinner one evening. A mutual friend of Thelma. Marty Scorsese's editor is Thelma Schumacher, who was married for, not long enough to Michael for a time. And we got to meet and had a wonderful, just a great old time talking about movies.
Did you tell him that, you know, as a kid,
God,
he shaped your career?
I was just a complete fanboy.
Is it true, George, as well, that you had not quite a run-in, but you had a shared interest in Tales of Hoffman with Scorsese?
Yes.
As well.
Funny story. I used to, back in the day, the only way you could have a movie on your wall at home was to go rent a projector, a 16 millimeter projector, and rent a print. And so Janus Films, I used to go down to Manhattan and rent from Janus Films The Tales of Hoffman and look at it over and over and over. And it was always available. It was never, you know, if you went for one of the popular films, you know, the chances were you'd be disappointed. It would be out, like any rental library. And one day it was out. And I said, who's got it? And the guy said, I don't know. He didn't know. Some kid over in Brooklyn. Okay. So it happened again. And after this happened two or three times, then apparently that kid from Brooklyn started to complain when I had it out. And apparently we were the only two people that were ever taking this film out. And that kid turned out to be Marty Scorsese.
Wow, amazing. And have you ever had a conversation with him about that?
Yes, we have. Yeah, we have. We shared some good laughs over that.
It's interesting because we started off talking about your relationship with Dario Argento. And there was this great I was going to say coven of horror directors in the 70s. It was John Carpenter, Wes Craven, David Cronenberg, people like that.
Right.
Did you ever hang out in a way? You've always seemed in a way separate from those guys.
I guess, yeah. Well, I was in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, you were in Pittsburgh. And you started before any of them as well, which about 6 or 7 years before Carpenter. And
really? Wasn't David doing...
Well, he was doing experimental stuff with his...
I guess.
Yeah, he didn't really start until...
And Carpenter, when did he do...
70, 73, 74, he would start. So,
is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Guess I'm the grandpa. But
more the uncle, I would say.
Anyway, no, we never hung out too much. I hung out for a time. It's always happenstance, you know? Mm. It's it was again through a mutual friend, a Pittsburgher named Tom Atkins. Yeah. Who worked in a couple of Carpenter films, that I met John. Mm. And through him, I met Adrienne. And, you know, it's this sort of incestuous thing that goes on. But so John and I hung out with Adrienne and for several years, and we still email each other. And
yeah.
So we have that kind of relationship. And Wes, I see, you know, occasionally. Dario, of course, but... I don't know. I'm not, you know, most of the rest of the time is sort of, you know, ships passing.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, John Waters, you know, I think the most I've ever done is have a beer with him. Mm-hmm. But we've met several times, but it's usually at some sort of a festival or a convention, you know, one of these horror conventions. Mm. I go to these conventions and a bunch of old friends are there, you know, Savini's always there. And but we never get a chance to hang out because, you know, we just sit at the autograph tables.
That's it. Bust in and then bust out again.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You mentioned Pittsburgh. You moved there off to New York and went to college there, didn't you?
Yes.
Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah.
And then you stayed.
Yeah.
Was that an easy decision to make? You just put down roots and wanted to be there and a great place to make films? Or
yes, it was an easy decision. And actually, I fled New York. I mean, I never really knew Manhattan except to go down to Janus to rent a movie. So I grew up in the Bronx, and I was a Latino. My dad was from Cuba. And so, you know, I was one of the sharks, and the Jets were always beating me up. So. So I really had not a very good time growing up in New York there. And I was always interested in, you know, screwy things and making little 8mm movies. And so, you know, I wasn't popular that way at all. And so I was happy to get out. And, happy to stay in Pittsburgh and met a bunch of people for the first time who were interested in and actually studying theater. And so, you know, friendships developed. Among them were the, you know, the guys, the Image 10 people that, mm-hmm. you know, we remain friends to this day. There is currently a theatrical live theater production of Night of Living Dead going on right now in Toronto, where I live now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I saw Russ and Jack, and the boys were up to promote that. And, you know, great friendships, long-term friendships that developed over that period.
And now you live in Toronto, as you said.
Yeah.
You moved there after Land of the Dead? Did you fall in love with the city? Or
I fell in love with the city when I made a little film called Bruiser.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
prior
yeah.
to that.
Yeah.
And did all the work in Toronto and fell in love with the crew and crews. You know, I thought the work ethic was phenomenal. And Pittsburgh for a while was sort of a production center. A lot of Hollywood films were coming in there. And then all of a sudden it dried up. And so many of my friends had to leave because they couldn't make a career in Pittsburgh. Mm. And so I was the next one to go, I guess. And we had a little bit of money. We had a $5 million budget from Canal Plus to make Bruiser. Mm-hmm. Found out that in Canada that five turned into six.
Wow.
And went to Canada. And I just fell in love with the place, Toronto. And then when Land of the Dead happened, I moved back and basically have stayed around.
So you don't have to be in Hollywood these days.
I never did.
You never were, obviously. Yeah.
I never was. I made two studio films for Orion, which some will say that it's not really a studio. But it was supposed to be the filmmaker's studio, and actually I had a very hard time with those guys right at that time. They were in bad shape. They made all the wrong decisions on their films that they liked and films they didn't like, sold off all the good ones and hung on to the bad ones.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then, so I've only made those two films. Creepshow was distributed by Warner Brothers, but it was financed by United Distribution, the same guys that financed Knight Riders and small independent financing for Creepshow. And then Warner Brothers picked it up. And in fact, Land of the Dead was done with an independent producer, Mark Canton.
Yes.
And Universal picked it up.
Yeah.
So I've only done those two films for Orion.
So have you ever put yourself through the studio mill over the years? I mean, I know that The Mummy was something that almost happened for you, and that was with Universal, wasn't it? Or was that an independent project?
Yes, that was Universal.
Yeah.
And we almost had it.
Yeah.
But couldn't get out. Yeah, no, I was did the whole studio scene, writing. My partner and I, Peter Grunwald, we were out there for years, 4 or 5 years, writing scripts, writing screenplays, rewriting screenplays. Made more money than I've ever made in the rest of my career, but never made a film.
Yeah.
And it was in reaction to that. And misunderstandings and things. MGM was promised to make a film called Before I Wake and had a lot of money invested in it. And one of the executives there said, I'll step in front of a bus if we don't make this movie.
Wow, that's nice. So,
yeah. He never did step in front of the bus. But they didn't make the movie. And that's what kept... There were only 12 days left on that contract. And that's what kept us from doing The Mummy. Because The Mummy was greenlit. Universal greenlit The Mummy.
Right.
Not The Mummy that was eventually made. Mm. It was a screenplay that I wrote.
Yeah.
Much closer to the Karloff. They wouldn't let us out of the contract on Before I Wake. And then it became a pissing contest between the two studios. So,
wow,
that one blew up, and that's one of the Goosebumps. I mean, we worked on so many big projects and rewrote them for different stars, and it just got a real taste of what that process is like, and you just spend your life sort of on the edge of hope, Nothing ever happened. In response to that, I wrote Bruiser. I said, I can do this for not so much money. And we raised the money from Canal Plus and went to Canada and shot it.
Because there's a whole raft of unmade George Romero projects that are out there. Apartment Living, for example, is that something which is about an apartment? Correct me if I'm wrong. That is alive.
It's alive.
Craves blood. Yeah. How did that not get made?
I know. It beats me.
Yeah.
Couldn't sell it. I mean, we just couldn't sell it. I guess it was, again, largely comedic, and at that time, and still, I think that people feel that you can't mix horror and comedy. Then somebody proves that theory wrong, and a lot of them come back and get made.
Yeah.
But in that case, we could never revisit that because it was owned by somebody else initially. The rights were owned by somebody else. I had just written the screenplay.
Okay.
And then a bunch of them, a project called Moon Shadows, which I still love, a project that, and a project called... Before I Wake, we still have a bunch of them.
Yeah,
some of which my partner and I still own and still have some hopes for. But You know, you get so tired of kicking around, and you know, I at this point I don't have time to sit around and you know spend 2 or 3 years developing something.
Sure.
And, I just don't have the time to do that anymore. If I'm lucky, I'll make you know 1 or 2 more films. And right now, zombies seem to be over populating the landscape.
I'm surprised there's none in here now, to be honest.
I scratched hard enough. Anyway, so I'm doing a comic book right now.
Yeah.
It's my way sort of escaping.
This is Empire of the Dead.
Yeah.
With Marvel.
Empire of the Dead for Marvel, yeah. That's.
And that's not going to be a film at any point. This is something that you... purely conceived as a comic
book. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't
never say
that
never.
Far.
Okay. Okay.
I'm actually writing it in screenplay form on a screenplay writing program, which Marvel said was okay, so that when Peter and I come away, it'll be huge. It'll be like a 300 pager, but because it's 15 books.
Wow. Well,
So, but I would hope that maybe it could become, you know, possibly a TV series or I don't know.
Okay.
See.
A lot of people want to know how your novel is going at the moment. Are you still working on that?
I pick it up and abandon it every once in a while. I haven't been able to fully commit to it. I guess I keep in the back of my mind say, okay, one of these days. I'll just, you know, stop kicking around and just sit and write. But I haven't really been able to do that. But
At Few from the Loo 3, ignore the name, asks, the likes of Knight Riders and Martin are as brilliant as your other films, the zombie films. Will you ever direct a non-zombie film again? Is that something that you're working on, I guess, specifically now? Or
specifically, no.
No?
Okay. No, I don't. I have a couple of these projects that I just mentioned that Peter and I still control.
Yeah.
And a couple of them I would really like to do. And they're both non-zombie films. Mm. One never knows, you know. Mm. As I say, it's all about, you know, finding the money and taking that time. And it's always, particularly these days, it's impossible. Nobody wants to hear about a $20 million budget. It's got to either be $2 million or $200 million.
Mm.
That's the only sort of interesting interesting way for studios to get interested. Mm. And so that's pretty frustrating. It's hard to go down the middle of the road, you know, and I can do this for $18 million. Well, no one's going to be impressed.
Yeah,
it means no stars. It means no big CG budget, you know. Mm. And that's the way they see it.
But you have had visions in the past that are equally as epic as, say, for example, World War Z, which came out this year. And, you know, your original script for Day of the Dead was enormous.
Yeah.
And would have been just huge. Do you regret in the way that didn't happen? Because you've said, and Day of the Dead is my favorite of your movies as well.
Right.
And that movie now to me seems so perfect in retrospect that maybe the original script might not have turned out as well, or do you think?
I think it wouldn't have.
Yeah.
That's partly what I mean. That decision, the United Film, that they're the ones that financed that, and it really was not. It looked like about between 6 and 7 that we could do it.
Okay.
Again, small, independently done. It was a lot more in Florida, so. We never really ran numbers, you know. We never really cut it that fine, but it looked like we could do it for 6.5-7. They wouldn't do it unrated at that budget, and they said, "Well, if you want to go unrated again, because they had released Dawn of the Dead bravely, I would say unrated in the States, and in order to leave it alone, and so." I decided that, well, I'd rather go in and cut this down so that we can do it. They said their ceiling was 3 if we wanted to do an unrated film. And so I said, I'll cut it down and do it for 3.
Wow.
And I think it was the best decision that, you know, it was sort of forced on me, but it was a great decision because it's cleaner. It makes all the points that the longer I wouldn't say longer, but bigger scope, didn't add anything.
Yeah, more characters, and you cut a lot of characters out.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Right.
And I've got to let you go in a second, George, but you mentioned Knight Riders there.
Yeah.
And when we mentioned you on Twitter, there was a lot of love, and I love that film as well. There's a lot of love for Knight Riders. Is that something that you found has grown over the years? Because I got the impression that when it came out that it was, people expected you, they pigeonholed you as the horror guy, yeah. And then you come out with this bizarre, weird, modern-day Arthurian tale with Ed Harris, and people didn't know what to make of it initially.
Oh, I know. They didn't. But they didn't know what to make of Day of the Dead either, you know? Yeah. They wanted a remake of Dawn. And so all anybody wants me to do is remake Dawn, man! And, you know, that's almost as far as it goes. I love Knight Riders. I mean, yeah. It's one of my... Martin is my favorite film of mine.
Okay.
And Knight Riders runs a very close second. Mm-hmm. And Day is my favorite of my zombie films. But I didn't know what to expect going into that. And of course, Ed was marvelous. Ed Harris was really sensational. And I don't think it would have worked without him.
Is it true you were married on set of Knight Riders on the last day of filming?
Yes.
That must have been a hell of a rap party.
No, it wasn't. It was just convenience.
And that movie fostered your relationship with Ed Harris, and then you were able to persuade him to cameo in Creepshow.
I know, and I understand that's going viral, right?
It's going viral,
Seeing Ed Harris dancing is...
Yeah. So I have to ask you, how the hell did you get Ed Harris to dance?
It was in the script, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. I mean, and he did it. He did his own little number, and you know, all his those moves were...
Oh, I thought maybe you showed him those moves.
And... No. I couldn't do that, even then.
Fantastic. Well, George, it has been an absolute pleasure, sir. And best of luck with the talk at the BFI and Empire of the Dead and everything.
Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Thanks very much.
Thank you.